Hi, my name's Howard, and I'm an alcoholic. Now I'm nervous. Thanks, Natalie, for inviting me to do this. You know, this is very humbling to come up here. This place means a lot to me. And when Natalie asked me to do this, I kind of act all kind of smarmy and everything, like, yeah, sure, you want to, you know, but I had been given a heads up that the invite might be coming, so no, I really appreciate this. And let me tell you a little bit how I came to the How place. After the Aetna Insurance Company had decided I was sufficiently cured enough, I didn't have to be inpatient at Ridgeview anymore. They suggested, they required that, you know, after I was released from the outpatient program to each day to find a meeting. And I asked a family member who had been up here before how to, you know, where there were meetings, and told me how to get here. And I did a dry run and turned around and went back home, and I said, honestly, I said, I followed your directions, but all I found was a biker's bar. No, that was it. And then, you know, a funny thing happened on the way here. Sobriety. The first meeting I came to at the How place was at the Sober at Six meeting. And then the next time I came, I figured that if they released me from Ridgeview at noon, I could get up here for the 1 o'clock meeting. At 2 o'clock, I had the rest of the day to myself. But it got to be a lot more than that. Being required, and I kind of took that as very literally, like I was required to get to a meeting or else I don't know what the consequence was going to be, but it had to have been bad. I came back because I liked what the people and the message and what they were telling me. And I keep a log that started about 6 weeks after my sobriety date, and I log every meeting I've been to. And it's probably 94% accurate. Now, the first time I came to the Breakfast Club was on September 1st of 2009. Now, I looked at that date when I went back and looked at that. That's just funny because that was the day I started at Walmart. So apparently, I came to a meeting I hadn't been before, and I started working at Walmart just right up the road here. I guess I needed a little boost of serenity. But my sobriety date is August 24th, 2008. And about the only thing I did right that day was I didn't drink. Because as I go along, you'll find out what the consequences, what happens to me when I try to stop drinking and on my own, when it's my idea, and do it all, you know, without help. I was born in the Methodist Hospital in Peoria, Illinois, October 16, 1950, which makes me older than most of you, not all of you, but and there's a lot of, if I were to tell my entire story, we'd be here for a while, but luckily my drunk log isn't that exciting, isn't that funny, and the recovery is relatively short. I grew up in a small, and I mean small, village just north of Peoria, about 250 people at the time, Spring Bay. I was baptized into the Spring Bay United, well, actually, with the at the time, it was the Spring Bay Evangelical United Brethren Church, which merged it with the Methodist Church to become the United Methodist Church. and there wasn't any drinking involved. There was one tavern and one church, and then at one point there were two taverns and one church, and then recently, about a year and a half ago, that one tavern burnt down, so the church is still there. But alcohol wasn't involved in my story growing up, other than the fact that prior to my birth, my dad worked for Pabst for 13 years, and then he worked at the world's largest bourbon distillery, Hiram Walker's in Peoria, for 27 years. And but he didn't drink. And my mom didn't drink, and except, you know, a beer. Dad would have during the summer, when he cashed his paycheck, he'd have a beer, maybe two, and that was it. Being a company man, every Christmas they would give him a fifth of Walker's Deluxe, which was their, at the time, their eight-year-old bourbon, good stuff. And it would be there by the time next Christmas rolled around. You know, they just kept it underneath the counter. In my mom and dad's families, family reunions, there was no alcohol or anything like that. There was, between my mom and dad, there's 17 siblings. One known alcoholic, my Uncle Ben. So they named me after him. But my middle name's Benjamin. Howard came from a family friend. He was a barber. I have two brothers and a sister. I'm the youngest in my family, and my two brothers are also recovering alcoholics. And my sister, she thinks she may have the family trait also. She just never put it to the test. So growing up, you know, alcohol is not a big factor. I mean, even I worked at the distillery for a short time when I was going to a junior college in near Peoria. And the fun part didn't start until I got finished up at the junior college and transferred to the big university in Illinois State University. My junior year of college, and that's where I had my first drunk. I do experience the alcohol before, but not to the point of, you know, triggering anything. And that's, you know, had the first. That's where the alcohol came with a pleasant experience and present memories. Just, you know, I know the first time that I got drunk, I felt bad the next day and vowed I was going to do that again. Illinois State University is located in the city of Normal, Illinois. Yes, from the very start, I was a normal drinker. You know. And it was party time from that point on for the next 2 years, and I went to summer school during the summer in between those 2 years. And the party continued. I lived off campus for most of the time. And still, you know, alcohol still had it was associated with good times at that point. When I graduated from college. I actually did graduate in 4 years, and I don't know. I wasn't a good student. I took the path of least resistance. I was Illinois State University is a teacher's college, but you know, I was a business major, and trying to do anything in, you know, along with my degree, I failed miserably at, and so. And there were times after college when I was drinking and drinking out of control. I got my only DWI That's what they were called. That's what they called it back then, DWI. In 1974, and I was pulled over by two cops from Washington, Illinois. And the first cop asked me to step out of my car, and as I was getting out, the other one was walking up, and he goes, "Hey, Howie." He was a guy I knew from high school. But the whole attitude in about drunk driving at that time was a lot. It's different than it is today. It's not treated as seriously, and it's not. And with the dire consequences that it's more correctly, they do it better today than they did back then. I was clearly over the limit. And the limit then was a lot more generous than it is now. But that, so the consequences weren't that great, so that they had no really effect on me. And having failed at everything I tried to do, I thought maybe here's what I do. By that time, the shooting was over in Vietnam. Everybody had come home. So I got brave and I enlisted. I had a high draft number in the first draft lottery, so I wasn't exposed to the draft. So I went into the Air Force, and they put me into electronics training. And again, once I got to my first duty station, there again, I fell into with the guys that I knew from the barracks and drinking a lot, drinking out of control. Got pulled over on base one time, and I got a ticket for sliding through a stop sign. If they'd given me a field sobriety test, I would have failed miserably. I got, things just. Somebody, something, somewhere was looking out for me, because when I called into the commander, he just shook his head and, what are you doing out at 3:30 in the morning on a work night, And it was there that I was volunteered to go to TDY, I was at Pope Air Force Base in North Carolina. I was sent down to a school down in MacDill Air Force Base in Tampa. And there was this other airman who looked a lot better in olive drab than I did. And we went out on a double date. But we weren't each other's date. But I was with this other gal, and she was with a date the other guy. But we kind of hit it off, and then she's stationed at Shaw in South Carolina. It was about 125 miles. And after we got done with that school, I went back to North Carolina. She went back to South Carolina. I got her number, but I didn't call. And then shortly, several months after that, I was sent down to Eglin Air Force Base for exercise. And I walked into the Quonset hut on the world's largest military installation. I was the only person from my unit and from Pope to was sent down there. And I walked in that Quonset hut to where I was found, and there she was sitting again. Well, that just seemed like too great of a consequence. So we started dating, and before I was sent to Italy and she was sent to Belgium, we decided we were going to make this permanent. And we did. We hopped back to the States at some point, and then we got married on her mother's lunch hour in Mobile, Alabama. We went to get our marriage license at the courthouse in Mobile, and the gal at the desk of the guy says, "Well, you want to get married now?" Well, her mother was there. We go, "Well, yeah, okay," and so we got married then. And then shortly after that, now there's a whole funny story, but it has, we don't really have the time for it. I went back to Italy. She went back to Belgium, and I didn't see her again for 6 months until I got assigned with her up in Belgium. Now, that marriage has lasted so far this past November 10th, 36 years. Yeah, oh, wow. You know, we, a lot of us lose a lot when we, from this disease. And I realize that, and I appreciate the stories of people, what they go through and what the families have to go through. I've been so blessed that I'm still in the house that, we bought 25 years ago. She stuck through me, stuck with me during that, all that time. And I can only say that, you know, it's a testament to her and to my daughter and to God that I've been able to survive through all that. When we got together in Belgium, in Italy, I was drinking out of control. They had an all-ranks club, and I would close that down on a nightly and then walk back to my apartment. And I didn't drive when I was in Italy. Those guys are crazy. They'll take a three-lane, a two-lane road and make it a four-lane. And they flash their lights at you as they're coming at you to make you disappear. I can only think that's the only reason they're doing that. And when I joined her up in Belgium for the next 2.5 years or so, all that, I put it aside. The alcohol was no longer, it was in the background. We drank with friends. And it wasn't a matter of me, you know, going out and staying out to 2:30 in the morning or anything like that. And as I come in here and try to piece together why that is, I come to the realization that on my own, I don't do well. When it's only me looking after myself and my welfare, I don't do that well. If I was with my family growing up, or if I'm in a structure, then I, you know, somebody else is responsible for me, keep me under control. I can thrive under that. But what happened was, after we got back from the Europe, and we got out of the Air Force and settled down in Mobile. We lived in Mobile for about 5 years, and we lived in Texas for a couple of years, and then we came to the Atlanta area. Jobs was a factor in that. And I took a job in field service, which required a lot of traveling. And the first job I had, it took me to a lot of places around the country, and also sent me to Europe a couple of times. I was able to spend 3 weeks in Lisbon overseeing the installation of the first paging system that they had in the country of Portugal. And I got to take a trip, a short trip to Bern, Switzerland, places I would never have otherwise gone had it not been for the job I held. And I went, I changed from there to another job in field service, which really had me on the road a lot. You know, I'd leave on Monday, come home on Friday, get my paperwork done, do my laundry, and back out again. And then I started bypassing the hotel lounge to where what I did is I took my $30 per diem and I would buy an Arby burger and some whiskey and take that back up to the room with me. And that started about an 18-year period of where I was drinking to the point of passing out, coming to the next day, trying to get through the day to where I could get back into isolation again and doing it all over again. And when I came off of the road and back into the family situation full time, I passed over that tripping point. No longer was the structure that I was in strong enough to keep me away from what I wanted to do, which was to drink. I missed a lot of my daughters growing up because of that. And it put a real strain on the family. But I didn't care. You know, and it wasn't that I didn't care about their feelings. I didn't care about, not that I ever forgot, ever stopped believing in God. I just quit caring. Because the only thing that I thought about that was concern to me was that I had enough alcohol with me to get me through the night. And having lived in Alabama and Texas, and now Georgia, mainly the laws in Georgia, I had to really plan for on weekends because you couldn't get alcohol on Sunday. I have long since been a bar drinker. It was all, totally in my room, in isolation. And then if Christmas were to fall the day before, on Saturday or a Monday, then I really had to plan to make sure I got through a long period of time for alcohol. Holidays were no different. People say, when they come around to this time of the year, how do we make it through the holidays? It's not a trigger for me. It made no difference what day it was. At some point during the day, in the afternoon, I was going to start drinking to the point of passing out, coming to the next day. And then it got to where I finally got a job. It was a career. It's the type of position that once people get this job, they stay in it for 30, 40 years. Big telephone company. The big, tall building in downtown Atlanta, midtown Atlanta, Bell South. And then one day, I went into work. And about midway through the morning, I could not bear to be there another minute. The way I put it is I took my job down to Midtown. I didn't lose my job. I just took it down to Midtown, and I dropped it off and went back home. I could not stay there because that period of time, all I wanted during the day, I was looking forward to getting home, fighting the traffic to get home to where I can start drinking again. Where I couldn't do that anymore. I had to be, at every waking moment had to be done with alcohol. And shortly before that time, on Halloween night in 2007, you guys hear me. I like to laugh. I like to tell my stories and share with a little bit of humor. So I say that, and it's serious stuff that what I'm talking about here. But like it says page 132, outsiders are sometimes shocked when we burst into merriment over something. Tragic experience from our past, I say there's a switch in my house that turns the basement steps from steps into a ramp. And just as I was walking down those steps, somebody flipped that switch and I went tumbling down. I dislocated my left elbow severely and tore the artery out of my elbow. And all I remember is I somehow made it back up the steps, and I remember grabbing the phone, and blood was getting just shooting over the phone. And my wife, who had lost a lot of her hearing from her days in the service, was off in another part of the house, and all I did was say, "Janet." And she heard that. And her sister was living with us, and she said it would look like a crime scene. And it took 5 units of blood before they could detect a pulse in me. So they put this external brace on me. I had two surgeries that night, and another surgery, and then another surgery after that to repair the damage I'd done to my elbow. And I decided, you know, I was drunk when that happened. Maybe I better change my habits here. So I did for about 2 months. Went back to drinking. Started buying pint bottles. Then bigger, 750 milliliter. That was awful inconvenient. So right back to where I was. The pattern had started all over. Getting the biggest bottle of whiskey I could find. And just shortened down the trips that I had to make. Then in April of the next year, 2008, I decided I was going to quit drinking. And I quit, and for about 2 days. And then here's the next thing I remember. My wife's shaking me. I'm asleep in the living room on the couch, and she wakes me. She says, "How are the ambulances here?" So I got up. I went and got with the people in the ambulance, and they asked me about Kennestone, "You know why you're here?" I said, "I must have fallen down the steps again." "No, you were in seizure. Alcohol withdrawal." See, I was flopping around on the floor, and my wife had found me doing that. And that didn't do it either, because I was still convinced that I was in control of this thing. That I quit on my own. I had quit smoking in 1984, and I'd done it without any problem. I just decided I wasn't going to quit. I was going to smoke cigarettes anymore. I tell it this way. I went into the 7-Eleven in Mobile, and they wanted 75 cents for a pack of Marlboros, and I refused to pay that. It's true, but that's not true. I put down cigarettes. But that gave me the self-knowledge that I could do anything I wanted to do, just as I just had to put my mind to it. I was going to take a trip up to my hometown, Illinois, for my 40th high school reunion. And I was going to drive. So I decided, I'll just wean myself off of alcohol so I can make this drive without, getting drunk. Here's the words I use. When remember last time you did it? I said, "Yeah, but I won't let that happen." So I quit drinking, and guess what? Same thing happened again. I went back into DDTs, back down to the hospital, and I asked the doctor, and there's another difference this time. I remember some of the things that happened during that trip down to the hospital. I remember when I started shaking out of control. When the phone rang and I tried to answer it, and I tried to hand it to my sister-in-law, and my hand was just uncontrollably shaking. I mean, not shakes like we get in the morning, I mean, tremors. And, I went to the hospital and they admitted me. I asked the doctor not to admit me. I can do this. I can do this. He said, "No, we need to keep you here." And the first or second night I was in the hospital that time around, I had this, my first spiritual experience. I was being tied down to my bed, force-fed by Satan. And Satan was this male nurse, and his minions were all dressed in white around him, and you know, and I was screaming. I remember this. I can still remember this. They were gathered around him, you know, they were all scared. Why? Because I was fighting them. I was screaming, I was yelling at every person I could think of, hollering out my wife's name until I was hoarse. And I remember, you know, when they tried to give me some soup, I twisted my head around because I knew if I ate that soup, I was going straight to hell. The next morning I wake up, I'm still strapped to my bed, and I said, that was just a dream. That was just a dream until that guy that was the nurse came in. He says, "Mr. Mixon, you sure gave us a rough time last night." Yeah, and you're Satan. You know, but at that point, I kind of figured that the gig was up. And that was August 24th, 2008. Like I said, about the only thing I did right that day, the reasons for doing it was all wrong. The way I did it was all wrong. But since that time, something's happened. I asked for help. I knew I couldn't go home. My wife had already told me at one time that if you go back to drinking again, just keep on going. I didn't want to put that to the test. And I was somewhat familiar with some of the treatment facilities. And we had good insurance. So I asked to go to Ridgeview, and they took me down to Ridgeview, and this is after two or three nights at Kennestone, and they took me to the detox unit. I still needed more detox, spent two nights in detox. Then I went over to the men's recovery residence. I try to get back to Ridgeview, not as often today as I used to, but on my anniversary date, I try to go back down to Ridgeview on the first Friday meeting down there out of gratitude to the people there, the doctors, the nurses, the staff, food service workers. They, as far as I know, they got the best institutional breakfast I've ever, you know. And I would, you know, I'd go back there. But then what they did is my sponsor calls it the $30,000 big book. And they started suggesting that, you know, I read that, get a sponsor. I got a sponsor while I was down there. He lasted until we were working on the fourth step, and he looked at my list of resentments, and he says, "Let's meet back here next week, and you come with 20 more resentments." And then he told me it took him 25 hours to do his fifth step, and I knew I couldn't do that without a bathroom break. So, plus, we were on different planets. You know, he was a drug addict; I'm an alcoholic. Now, I'm leaving the drug part of my story out of there because there is no drug story. My problem is alcohol. I don't abuse pain pills, marijuana. All it did was give me a sore throat. You know, I was a college student in the 70s, doggone it. You know, I didn't see the point. Alcohol, that's the thing that I'm addicted to. That's what has power over me. When I let it have that power, it's alcohol. So, like I said at the beginning, they suggested, so that's, I got another sponsor, the one I've had since that time, shortly after that, and he took me through the steps. He's the one that made me get down on my knees in Gritter's Library to say the third step prayer. You know, try not to be self-conscious about it. Being humble and realizing that, and finally making that admission that I was powerless over this brown stuff that comes in a bottle. And since that time, since that date, August 24th, 2008, by the grace of God, this program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have not had a desire, I haven't had even a thought come in my mind what it would be like to take a drink. That had been, from the time that I hit that tripping point, and it was one of those broken shoelaces thing that started that thing when I was in field service, to that point in 2008, 18 years, all of a sudden, not all of a sudden, but there was a switch that went off, that when I held out my hand, I said the words, the magical words. You know, how many people here can remember the first time you said your name and you are an alcoholic? I do. My name's Howard, and I am an alcoholic. No, who said that? Haven't made that admission. It was out there. It's in the universe. I can't take it back. And I realized that you know, the power has to come from somewhere else to get over this. I got into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and doing the work. Coming here, first coming up here to the Howe Place on a daily basis, going to the first 15, 18 months of sobriety, I averaged over 2 meetings a day. I still go to average more than 1 meeting a day. Let me tell you something that happened. 5 years after that, I did make that trip. I went up to my 45th reunion last year. And once again, they're having it in a bar. The one night's festivities, they're having a bar. But I did it the right way this time. I told my sponsor, I told people in here that I was making this trip. It was going to be a riverboat cruise with a Jimmy Buffett tribute band. Yeah. You think there was going to be any alcohol involved there? And I had set up a point. I had to meet with, you know, back in 75, I stood up for a couple as the best man at their wedding. And pretty much after that, I had dropped out of their lives. So I needed to get a hold of them. They're still married. And to let them know that, you know, what happened to the guy in their wedding pictures. And so I made my amends to them at dinner. My sponsor called me during the dinner, just checking up on me. Then I went to the bar where they having the first night of festivities and, you know, met some of the guys there. And nobody cared that I wasn't drinking. Somebody offered me for being the person that had traveled the farthest. You can have this bottle of wine, you can have this bottle of wine, or you can have this t-shirt. I took the t-shirt. But had I taken I did with the t-shirt what I hope I would have done with either bottle of wine, and I gave it away. I went on a riverboat cruise. And that's what happened in that five-year period, is that there was this psychic change, this spiritual awakening that comes as a promise to this program. And it wasn't that far along that I realized that I do not have this desire to drink. Now, when I first thought about that, I went down and talked to Sam down at Ridgeview, and I sat in his office, and I said, I don't have this desire to drink anymore. Should I be concerned about that? And he said something, I think the point he was trying to make was, you know, you've gotten yourself into a program, and that's what, you know, what happens when you're serious about the program. What his actual words were was stupid. How many meetings do you go to? Yeah, I go to a lot of meetings. But also, I'm serious about this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm passionate about it, and I hope that comes through. A lot of times, you know, I do things for the laugh. But I am serious about this. I don't know if I would have survived another couple of years of drinking. I may have. But the life I had at that point was empty. It was without caring. It was without humor. This program has given that back to me. I've got friends that I didn't have before. I got a relationship with my wife, my daughter. My first grandson lived in our house for his first 11 years, and for the first 7-8 years of his life, I was in that out of control drinking. This past 4 months ago, yesterday, my second grandson was born. And the grace of God and this program that I care so much about, if I stay with that, he won't have to know his grandfather as that drunken guy with the wild beard with forest creatures living in it. Some of you might remember what that guy looked like. You know, it doesn't have to be convinced that a daily shower is a good idea. Able to hold a job now. It's not much of a job. It's not nearly like the one I dropped off down in Midtown. But I do that with a commitment. I show up every day on time when I can. And if the thought ever creeps in my mind that maybe I've been to enough meetings this week, I can skip one. Something's inside of me saying maybe not. This has been working so far. Why mess it up? I'm so thankful that you asked me to do this. This place here means the world to me. The friends I have and the meetings I go to around here, you mean a lot to me. This program means so much to me and to my wife. When she's never asked me not to go to a meeting. And every time I come back home from a meeting, she asks me how was the meeting. She doesn't know what we do in here. She doesn't know what we say. We could have secret handshake. We could be playing with snakes and stuff. She doesn't know. She doesn't care. Because the guy that came back into that room, into that house, was a lot better person than what went out. It's not so much that I'm not drinking. There's that. That's the big part. But it's the living with the principles and the guidelines that's demanded of us in this program. I'd like to end with a reading that my group I go to more than any other group. We say this at the end of every meeting. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order, but obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right. Great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is a great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thank you.